Thank you, Steve, for reading for us. Thank you to everyone who has read so well thus far. Good evening, everyone. It's really lovely to have you with us tonight. My name is John. I'm one of the ministers here, and it's our hope that your Christmas is as happy as it possibly can be. And can I invite you to keep that last reading open in front of you? We're going to turn to it in just a moment, but I'd love to begin with a slightly embarrassing story. And let me take you back to Christmas 2017. Hillary and I hadn't been dating long, and I was desperate to make a good impression on my now in-laws. You know, that early relationship stage when you're trying to look calm while feeling internally like an absolute mess. One evening at her parents' home, my mother-in-law had arranged these beautiful nativity scenes around the living room. Peaceful, tasteful, very Christmassy. Most normal people would admire them quietly, say something polite, perhaps. For reasons still unknown to me, I decided this was the moment to comment on the historical accuracy of the figurines. So I said, oh, it's lovely, but technically, the wise men wouldn't have been there on the night Jesus was born. And then, because I panicked and I didn't know how to stop talking, I added, and also the animals probably weren't there either, and it was more like a guest room, and there might have been dozens, even hundreds of wise men, actually. Bibles were sourced, and the boyfriend was duly fact-checked. I was, of course, right. But absolutely no one was grateful for the unsolicited lecture on nativity accuracy. But that little moment does raise a gentle point, doesn't it? Christmas is full of images and traditions that we've gathered over the years. A bit of the Bible, a bit of Christmas card imagination, and suddenly we've got shepherds, wise men, and angels all crowded into a stable, as though everybody received the same Google Maps directions. None of that is bad. Much of it is really lovely. But it does mean the real Christmas story can get buried beneath the charming extras. This past week, some of us were out on the streets here in St. Andrews, chatting to people as we handed out invitations. We had a whiteboard with the question, "What makes Christmas special to you?" The answers were really lovely. Family, Christmas dinner, hot chocolate, coziness, films like Elf, The Holiday, and Die Hard. And all of these are good. They're part of what many of us treasure about this time of year. But it really struck me that almost none of the answers had anything to do with the actual Christmas story, the one that Matthew records, the one that Christians all around the world are celebrating this time of the year. Matthew isn't interested in tidying our nativity sets or settling Christmas film debates. He wants us to see who the child at the center of it all really is. That's Matthew's question. Who is this child and how are we going to respond to him? Because in Matthew's account that we just read, the birth of Jesus doesn't just make for a peaceful Christmas card. It causes shockwaves. It draws people from hundreds of miles away. It troubles a king. It disturbs a whole city. And it leads to radically different reactions. Hostility, indifference, joyful worship. So that's what we're going to do very simply for just a few minutes. Let's come to that first question that Matthew wants us to ask. Who is this child? And you'll have noticed our last reading begins. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king. That's it. No shepherds, no manger, none of the details we so often associate with Christmas. Why? Because Matthew doesn't want us to stop at the scene. He wants us to see the identity of the child. And the first thing he tells us is that this child is God's promised king. At Bethlehem in Judea is no throwaway detail. It's the city of King David of the Old Testament, the royal town the prophets of the Old Testament had pointed to for centuries as the birthplace of God's true king. Matthew mentions Bethlehem four times in the reading in front of us, as if underlining and highlighting the point again and again. Look here, the real king has arrived. And then these visitors appear, wise men from the east, asking, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? And they don't ask, where is the child who will one day become king? No. From his first breath, this child already is king. And Matthew shows that God has been pointing to this king for centuries. Herod gathers the chief priests and the scribes, the historians and scholars and PhDs of their day, and they quote the prophet Micah, written about 700 years before Jesus was ever born. And it's right there in the center of our reading in front of us. Out of you, Bethlehem, will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. A shepherd king. Not a tyrant, not a distant ruler, a king who protects and guides and cares, who will lay down his life for his people. And then there's the star. You don't have to be studying astrophysics to know that the star jumps out in the reading. Some of my friends say, John, there's no way I can believe these things actually happened. Stars moving, wise men traveling, angels appearing. And I get that instinct. I certainly used to think like that too. But sometimes I want to flip the question. If God really exists, and if he truly came into our world, wouldn't we expect some pretty remarkable things to happen? If God steps into history, his arrival would hardly be ordinary. So for Matthew, the star isn't a problem, it's a signpost. Look, the king has come. But Matthew wants us to see there's another king in the frame. We read in that first sentence, in the days of Herod the king. If this were the Christmas panto, this is the moment we all boo and hiss. Everyone knew Herod was the villain, Rome's appointed ruler, notoriously ruthless. Ancient historians describe him as paranoid and violent. And so Matthew is setting up a deliberate contrast, a clash of kings. Herod, insecure, self-protective, third king, who will one day lay down his life for his people. Herod willfully kills to stay king. Jesus willingly dies to save his people. And then Matthew adds one more remarkable detail about who this child is, and that is that he is the king for the whole world. Matthew just says that the Magi, the wise men, came from the east, which, let's be honest, covers a lot of ground. Babylon, Persia, Saudi Arabia, India, China. Ultimately, they're not part of Israel's story. They come from far away geographically and far away spiritually. And yet they are the first ones to kneel. Not just a king for one people, a king for all people, including those who feel far from God. I thought that was quite beautifully exemplified by all the different accents from the readers today already. So who is this child? Not a sentimental Christmas figure, not merely a great teacher. He's the shepherd king, the king for all people, the king who will one day give his life for his people. And if we just zoom out for a moment, this is the heartbeat of the whole of the Bible. God keeping his promises, sending his king, drawing people from every background to find life and hope in him. At Christians, we don't believe in Jesus because we're nostalgic. We believe because God kept his word. Because Jesus is the king who came not to take, but to give. The king who laid down his life for people who would reject him. And if he really is this king, it's no wonder his influence is unlike anything else in human history. No wonder his coming was predicted centuries beforehand. And no wonder that today, billions of people across the world from every continent and culture say they know him personally and follow him. That's who this child is. So if this child really is God's promised king, Matthew wants us to ask a follow-up question. How will we respond to him? And in our passage in front of us, we meet three responses that still appear today. You've got Herod, first of all. When Herod hears about the birth of Jesus, Matthew tells us he is troubled, deeply unsettled. And why? Because here is a king he didn't appoint, who he can't control and cannot remove. Herod has built his whole life on staying in charge, and when Jesus comes, a king with a higher claim, he panics. And while Herod's actions were extreme, the instinct is familiar. I imagine most of us wouldn't call ourselves hostile to Jesus, but maybe we resist the idea of someone else ruling our lives. We like being in control. And the Bible has a word for that instinct in all of us. It's sin. Not just the bad things we do, but the deeper impulse to run life our own way, to keep God at a distance, to sit on the throne of our own lives. Herod shows us that impulse in its most extreme form, but the same seed lives in my heart and in all of our hearts. And Jesus challenges that gently but clearly. He says, life works best when I'm at the center, not you. So Herod shows us one response, resistance. And the second response is subtle, but in some ways more tragic. Herod asks the chief priests and scribes where the Messiah will be born. And they know instantly. They know their Bibles. But nothing. Bethlehem is just 5 miles away from where they are. It's like from here to Guard Bridge. But they don't go. They don't investigate. It's possible to know the story well, to be familiar with the Bible and yet remain unmoved. And that's indifference. It keeps Jesus at arm's length. It says, I know the story, I'm just not sure it matters to me. And maybe that's some of us here tonight. But then the third response, which is the wise men. And Matthew tells us, if you just scan to the end of our reading, verse 10, the sentence beginning with the little 10, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And then the next sentence, verse 11, they fell down and worshipped him. And again, they opened their treasures, joy, humility, generosity. Everything Herod refused to do, they do. Everything the religious leaders couldn't be bothered to do, they do. Why? Because they've realized who this child truly is. And even their gifts whisper the purpose of his coming. Gold for a king. Frankincense for one who brings us to God. Myrrh, a spice used for burials, pointing forward towards his death. the baby king born to die. The Magi didn't know everything, but they knew enough. They knew this child was worthy of joy, of honor, of worship. And Matthew places these three responses in front of us tonight. He asks us gently, which one of these is you? And which do you want to be? Not to make us feel guilty or to force anything, but because if Jesus really is the promised king for everyone, our response matters. C.S. Lewis, who thought long and hard about these things, once wrote, "Christianity, if false, is of no importance. If true, of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important." And that's Matthew's point. If Jesus is not the true king, none of it matters. But if he is, then curiosity or polite interest isn't enough. Because this child didn't stay a child. He grew up, taught with authority and wisdom, welcomed outsiders with compassion. And then, in the greatest act of kingship the world has ever seen, he laid down his life for his people. And the shepherd king went to the cross to rescue wandering sheep. The true king died for rebels like me, to deal with our sin, to forgive us, to bring us back to God. And then he rose again, not just to prove who he is, but also to invite us into a new life with him. Maybe you're not sure what you believe. Maybe you've never looked at Jesus beyond the Christmas card version. But something in you wonders if this story might be true. If so, can I gently say, come and see, come and find out. Come with your questions, come with your objections, come with your doubts. One of the best ways is simply to read the story for yourself. Take a copy of Matthew's gospel tonight. It's our gift to you. Have a read over Christmas, see what you make of Jesus. Maybe talk to the Christian friend who brought you along. Ask them what they believe and why. I can guarantee we won't have all the answers, but they will have a story to tell, a story of how this king has met them, helped them, forgiven them, carried them. We'd love nothing more than to help you explore that for yourself. Let me wish you a very Merry Christmas. Again, I hope it's as happy as it possibly can be. Our prayer is that this is the Christmas that you see Jesus clearly and find, like the Magi, a joy deeper than you ever imagined. I'm going to invite the